So we've got about half an hour before we break for our lunch. So I just want to talk a little bit about the path we're studying this weekend. So really we're looking, like last weekend we were looking at the path between Hod and Gevuram. And we're really looking at the relationship between the mind and that deeper quality of will and clarity. And in particular, we were looking at the necessity of reversal, of turning the habitual habit of the mind upside down. Now, in this weekend, we're looking at the path on the opposite side of the tree, which is the connection between Netzach and Hesed, or Gedula. And here we're looking at the relationship with the whole world of feeling and desire, the Venusian world of Netzach. And that world of Jupiter and Hesed, which is that world of that deeper compassion, that quality of love that is connected to desire but transcends desire. And the tarot card that connects this path is the Wheel of Fortune. This very, very ancient image of the ups and the downs of life. You know, this the very old image of the some of the older images of the Wheel of Fortune, which is this very old image and the wheel of life carrying us up and casting us down, and carrying us up and casting us down, and within that whole idea is looking at the whole nature of the whirlpool of desire. Now, in the Kabbalah, desire is seen as a very important thing. Desire is a very good quality. Desire is a generative quality of life. But if desire becomes fixed and identified with and mechanical, then it becomes part of that kind of that continual interior dialogue that keeps us trapped in images of the past. And the one of the important things about life, and certainly when you get to my advanced age, is that the nature of desire changes. You know, the sort of, if I think of being 15, for example. Now, a 15-year-old boy, his desires are not subtle. The desires that are about sexuality and power. You know, and there's all kinds of other desires in there, but actually the desires are very, to an extent, hormonally based. They're also about that sense of wanting to be a man and not yet being a man, that whole adolescent kind of energy of kind of wanting to push forward, you know, and the desire to be separate, the desire to be independent, and of course, if we go back to a much earlier stage of life, we go back to being a toddler or something, which is a not dissimilar time to be adolescent in some ways. You have those same kind of energies, the desire for independence, the desire to say no, the desire to, you know, that power, desire to have sovereignty. But if we go through the stages of our life, the desire for autonomy is still there, the desire, you know, that deep quality of will. The desire to be loved and to love is still there, but that alters. And one of the important things that we find in this path is the desire of the heart that takes us beyond the personal into the deeper realms of the soul. This is the kind of desire we find in Dante. The desire you find in the troubadours, where you have an exterior image of being there in their way of doing it, and it's where Kipling in the poem talks of the way of a man with a maid, is the image of beauty and of longing, of something that would be ultimately fulfilling, appearing in the shape of a person. For Dante, this is the figure of Beatrice, whom he sees in church, whom he never gets to know, and who dies very young. He never gets to know her. There's no actual relationship there. But Beatrice in that moment is the shining vessel to which a deeper shape of beauty beckons. And in Dante's works, in particular in the, well, obviously in the Great Commedia, this desire for Beatrice, the love of Beatrice, the longing for Beatrice, takes him into an exploration of the entire universe and takes him in the, ultimately into the presence of the divine. And of course, the Commedia is the most, you know, the Inferno, the Purgatorio, the Paradiso. These are extraordinary kind of works, really, but are all fueled by this path, this old trail that is the new trail that Kipling speaks of. Find it also in his works, the Vita Nuova, the new life that appears when we follow that desire of the heart. The problem, though, the problem for many of us, though, is our desires become mechanical and object-related and fixed in old senses of object and old senses of self. You know, the classic things that happen to men in particular in middle life is the midlife crisis, the disrupting of relationships and the finding of a new young partner and the desire to be young again. I think it happened both sexes, but it's predominantly a male thing. And that desire to be young again, if that desire for newness and freshness at his heart is an innocent desire, if it is listened to in the right way, it takes us onto this path. Sadly, what normally happens is the person who doesn't listen to it in the right way goes into a repetitive old pattern, so instead of that desire and the beauty of that becoming iconic, there is a retreat into this what worked in the past. And so what you find people doing is creating older images of themselves as if they were young again, and finding a young partner or somebody else that represents the youngness that defends them against age. And there is a genuine tragedy in that. In that, not because there is, obviously, it doesn't work. It doesn't, you know, no matter how many ways you have of trying to convince yourself that you're young, you're really not. And aging continues. It just happens. You know, we do our best. You know, we live as best we can, we keep ourselves active, but of course we're aging and we will die. And that is immutable and inevitable. And the problem with immersing ourselves in the image of a if you like, an old youngness, of the familiar youngness, to try and reclaim something, is it closes ourselves to the deeper regions of this path, which takes us into new adventure, new mystery. One of the other great images of this path in the Western tradition is the quest for the Grail. Now, the great thing about the Grail is that everybody's got thousands of views of the Grail. The Grail is never described in all the texts. What you get are the fruits of the Grail, the new life that emerges as you follow the Grail. You get this very specific thing you get when the presence of the Grail appears, is your senses are magnified. You have this extraordinary smell, the smell of paradise. You are given the food that is precisely the food that you love to eat in that moment. So there's a real kind of, in the Grail stories, there is this sense of the of the sanctification of desire, when desire is moving in the right direction. So when desire is moving to the grail, moving into the mystery, ultimately into the art, into the direction of the divine, what happens, what we are met with is by exactly the right food to eat, exactly the smell, and exactly the sense of the new life, the genuine vita nuova, the new life that isn't a repetition of anything that has happened to us in the past. Now we find it in the Kipling poem. Is very poor Kipling is a complicated figure, isn't he? Because he's in these days when we're looking at the difficulties of colonialism. Here is a man right out of the British Empire, and some of his language and his poetry, his books is kind of it makes you kind of cringe, you know. Particularly when I think of the particular line in there that got me was the drunken Dago crew. And of course, you know, so Kipling's not an easy figure, but this was somebody who really did understand inner life and inner work and kept growing in his life. Now, he was a very jingoistic patriot in the First World War until his son was killed. And the effect of that was to really, really cause him to re-envisage many of his attitudes. But in this poem, The Long Trail, which is it's a great thing, really. It's very vigorous. It's very kind of, you know, if we look at what, and it speaks really to some of the aspects of this path. So I'll just read it again to you a little, and because actually where this poem begins is that it's the end of the year, in Britain. The hay is taken in, the kind of, and there's a sense of this sense of life having ended, right? The creative process having ended, and everything's been gathered in. The English summer's done. This, and it begins with, there's a whisper down the field when the ear has shot her yield. So it begins in this place of things have ended, where the ear has shot her yield. Okay, the hay is in, the ricks stand grey to the sun. And this whisper, there's a kind of whisper, which is like the whisper of the deeper soul, the whisper of the spirit somewhere. Over then, come over, for the bee has quit the Dover and your English summer's done. So it's sort of saying, well, actually, one thing is done. And then it brings, you've heard the beat of the offshore wind and the thresh of the deep sea rain. You've heard the song, how long, pull out on the trail again. So it's this invitation. So those things seem like they've ended. Everything has come to an end. And, you know, but actually what you hear is the call of new adventure. The offshore wind. You can hear the thresh of the deep sea rain. You're being invited into a new adventure. Ernest Butler, my teacher, would always quote this thing of how he was sort of looking forward to death, because death would be a new adventure. One of the things I loved about Ernest, really, was that he was this incredibly learned man, incredibly spiritual man, who'd been through many things, you know, been through the First World War, you know, was a machine gunner, had seen awful things, and began his life as an orphan, in a times when orphans were not treated well at all. Highly intelligent man who never, who in terms of his status in the outer world, never, because he was working class, because he was an orphan, never got a status in life that would have matched his gifts. You know, was turned to, when he tried to join the Society of the Inner Light, originally he was turned down because he was working class, and he didn't let oiks in those days. And, you know, his job, the last job of his life, he was a lab technician in Portsmouth, and having been a working engineer, and kind of, you know, but because this is somebody who, in a sense, in the outer world, had a very hard life. And had persevered and had followed his trail. And no matter how much he knew, no matter how much he'd been through, You know, he was constantly curious, constantly looking at the new adventure. You know, he had to have diabetes, he had his leg off, he was off pain with his leg. But he would hop around on his crutches and kind of and on his false leg and kind of and right to the end of his life, you know, he was constantly inquiring, constantly searching for the new trail. And in a way, you know, he loved, I mean, he really kind of, I mean, I wasn't, you know, as you can imagine, when I'm, you know, I come across him and I'm 18, I'm not really thinking of Kipling as somebody I want to read. And particularly in those days, you know, so we're talking, when I'm 18, we're talking 73. So the idea of reading Kipling, but he got me to read Kipling, and I'm always glad he did. I mean, I always have to deal with the colonial aspects of Kipling, but there are some amazing things here. So continue with the poem for a moment. Pull out on the trail again. Have done with the attempts of Shem, dear lass. We've seen the season through. It's time to turn the old trail, our own trail, the out trail. So to go into the new, to go into the kind of away from the known. Pull out on the long trail, the trail that is always new. Now that's that kind of desire of the heart, that familiar trail that kind of but is also new. When we connect to it, when we refind it. And then there's this great kind of, you know, his image of his trail. It's north you may run to the rime-ringed sun, rhyming the frosty sun, the cold sun, the sun of the north, or south to the blind home's hate, or east all the way into Mississippi Bay, or west to the Golden Gates. You know, so this wonderful vistas, the possibility of adventure. And west of the Golden Gate, where the blindest bluffs hold true, hold good, dear lass, and the wildest tales are true. And we're inviting you, you know, into the West. This is America, is drawing on the American myth of the West and the telling of tall tales and the kind. But the tall tales might be true. Because here in this place of adventure, there's all kinds of possibilities. Life runs large on the long trail, the trail that is always new. So the desire of our heart, this freshness of desire, the goodness of desire, when it's gone the right trail, when it isn't leading us into repetitive and old wounded, stuck situations. And then he reminds us why it's good to do this. The days are sick and cold, and the skies are grey and old, and the twice-breathed airs blow damp. So that sense of coldness, oldness, staleness. And he says, and I'll sell my tired soul for the bucking beam sea roll of a black Bilbao tramp steamer. He's talking about there. And he'd sell his soul. That's the thing about, that's the point to move away from tiredness, oldness, the familiar that chokes us. And then, of course, he says the complicated, difficult line, a drunken Dago crew, which is, of course, is not acceptable phrase to us. But the image that he's evoking, really, is this idea of Dagos being Spaniard, of this kind of tramp steamer with this kind of wild, drunken kind of crew that are going off into the mystery. And her nose held down on the old trail, our own trail, the out trail, from Cadiz south on the love. Now the trail from Cadiz south is the trail down into South America, down to the lands of mystery where all the gold is found. And then he says, it's interesting, there be triple ways to take, of the eagle or the snake, or the way of a man with a maid. Now the man and the maid is this troubadour thing, it's the Beatrice thing. But the ways of the eagle or the snake, so the snake is the kind of wriggling kind of way, the eagle is the soaring way. See, so what he's telling us there are all these different ways to do this. And then he says he's speaking of his path. But the sweetest way to me is a ship upon the sea. And he's a man who sailed a lot in his life and sailed to India, sailed all over the place and you can hear this is his speaking of his particular way. The sweetest way to me is a ship upon the sea in the heel of the northeast trade. Can you hear the crash on her bows, dear lass, and the drum of the racing screw, that's the propeller. as she ships it green on the old trail, our own trail, the out trail, as she lifts, the sense of the boat lifting, ascending on the long trail, the trail that is always new. See the shaking funnels roar with the Peter at the fore, and Peter's the helmsman at the fore, and the fenders grind and heave, and the derricks clack and grate as the tackle hooks the crate, and the fall rope winds through the sheaves. He's taking us into that image of a steamship, and of the kind of the movement of the metal, and of the gathering, and at the boat ports the gathering of cargo with the derricks. And then it's gangplank up and in, so you pull up the gangplank as you're about to kind of to set off, and the hawsers warp her through, so that the hawsers are the kind of the rigging, the kind of, and we're backing out on the long trail, and there's that image of the steamship backing out of the port. And then all we mutter overside when the port fog holds us tight, and we can't put out to sea, and the sirens are hooting their dreads, so we can't go to sea. But then foot by foot we creep over the hueless, viewless deep to the sob of the questing lead. Questing lead is the lead plumb that they because when you're ahead you have to keep plumbing the depth. The idea of plumbing the depth is so you don't run aground. So he's giving us this kind of image really of his kind of putting out to sea, being careful. It's down by the Lower Hope, dear lass, with the Grinfleet sands in view. I've no idea what the mouse is. Till the mouse swings green on the old trail, our own trail, the out trail, and the gull light lifts on the long trail, the trail that is always new. So it's got this image of us getting out to sea, and there being signs of us getting out to sea. And then what we encounter then is this new world, the blazing tropic night, where there wakes a welt of light that holds the hot sky tame. And the steady 4-foot snores through the planet clouded froze, where the scared whale flukes in flame. So we're right in the tropics, we're in this kind of, we're on the whale's track, we're seeing whales, we're kind of, we're sagging south on the long trail, the trail that is always new. Then home, get her home, where the drunken rollers comb and the shouting seas drive by, and the engines stop and ring, and the wet bows reel and swing, and the Southern Cross rides high. We're in the Southern Hemisphere, we're in those seas. Yes, and you can hear he's come from England, so he's excited. Yes, the old lost stars wheel back, dear lass, that blaze in the velvet blue. They're all old friends on the old trail, our own trail, the out trail. They're God's own guides on the long trail, the trail that is always new. Fly forward, oh my heart, from the foreland to the start. We're steaming all too slow. Come on, excitement, let's go more. And it's 20,000 miles to our little lazy isle where the trumpet orchids blow. You've heard the call of the offshore wind and the voice of the deep sea rain. You've heard the song, how long, put out on the trail again. The Lord knows what we may find, dear lass, and the deuce knows we may do. But we're back once more on the old trail, our own trail, the out trail. We're down, hull down on the long trail, the trail that is always new.
I need your phone.
So the...
Don't
worry, so sorry, I'll just interrupt you. I can use my phone for something. One second. Where is it? No, I think there it is, Ali. Okay, so what he brings us to really in the end of this poem is this sense of excitement, this sense of being. Now this is his journey; it's not our journey. Right, so when he's talking about this, the excitement of being on the steamship, of being in the Southern Oceans, seeing the familiar stars. But what he's pointing us to is that deeper kind of journey, really, as we put out from port, as we go into the kind of unknown, there are these signs that welcome us. And then what rises in the heart is this sense of what might call holy desire, a desire that is all goodness, that's taking us on into mystery, no matter how old we are, no matter how routine life. Now the power of this little poem is that it begins in a place where everything is over. Everything is done, the creative work is ended. The hay is in the barn, the harvest is gathered, the days are grey and dead. And then this is the moment of where the adventure begins. But we have to be prepared to put out to sea, to use his image. We have to be prepared to find the way out, the way forward, the old trail that is always new. So the sense of connecting to desire, connecting. Now, one of the things that happens to us as we get older is that we get hurt, we become disillusioned, we become saddened. Of course we do, but this is the world we live in. But one of the effects of that can be to dampen that spirit of adventure, to dampen our confidence in who we are and what we can be and how we can be met and held in the adventure. And in a certain sense, this path is all about that movement, refinding that, connecting to our desire. And from that desire, we take the path that leads to the place of compassion and love. So where this path leads us to is the path that where we are received in our particularity, in our particular offering that no one other than us can offer. And we are received and loved in that, loved for who we are, loved for how we are, in all our parts. So that's going to be the adventure of this weekend, really. That's what we're looking into.
Really furnish it with that sense of will and death's finger before, which has a quality of will. But this is kind of will, but with abundance and life and adventure and.
Yeah, we're doing a different place from that because actually that's the starkness of things, right? In the bones of things. Here we're with the flesh, the blood, the juice of things.
Yeah, yeah.
The fruit of life, right? And that lovely juiciness, in a sense, and the innocence of that, the innocence of desire. Desire gets such a bad press in lots of ways, and partly it does because a lot of the ways in which desire is manipulated in our culture it's very object related. It's very it encourages us to use the world rather than participate in the world. But what you hear in Kipling and kinds of and in other such stories and poems is a delight in the nature of the world. So it's the desire is a desire that does not objectify. It is a participative desire where we find we meet the other with love, are loved and love the other, and where desire magnifies our capacity to love. It opens the heart and enriches the heart. Now, the awful possibility, though, if we don't allow ourselves to nourish our desire, to is that we become dried out, desiccated. I always remember my father, because he was a very disillusioned and, truthfully, very embittered man, really. And he had this friend who was father was the head of department in a big comprehensive, and one of his friends was the janitor of the school. And one of the awful little rituals these two men would enact every day was they'd meet up and they'd say, "How are you doing? Oh, all right. Another day gone. Another day gone. Yeah, another day gone." And the absence of any life in that collusion between the two of them, really, you know, the absence of any newness, any possibility. My father would literally say to you, and he's a man who had travelled the world, but he would say, "One place is like another, every place is like another." And mean it. You know, awful. You know, he literally would meet, and I'm sure that would be his experience, because he would not allow in that sense of excitement, that sense of desire. And there are reasons for it. I know the reasons why he did that and understand that. But that is the dangerous place that can happen to us. If we give up on desire, if we give up on our excitement, the new sense of possibility. And so I always think of Ernest, really, and Tom as well, thinking about it. You know, Tom, when he was 70, decided to learn to drive, and did. Bought himself a lovely white Mini. She drove like a bloody... I don't know if he was a safe driver, not really, to be honest. Anyway, he never did have an accident, but he did, but he used to enjoy and really loved this gentle old man used to drive really fast around the little lanes of Essex and kind of and was always excited by it. And Ernest too, always that sense of excitement. This man with one leg and a painful old kind of false leg, not like the false legs people have these days, you know, would march around, would sort of bounce around, would kind of be perpetually curious and interested. And that's the stuff that lives in this path. I'll talk a little more later on today about the particular figure that appeared, who is Ellen, who is a figure that comes out of the Mabinogion. There's some very ancient, because she is this kind of figure who opens the way for us, who is this kind of, this Venusian figure. Now, one of the great kind of images in Western art we find is the figure of the goddess Venus, the Greek Aphrodite, who represents beauty. Now again, this is an image that gets massively abused and objectified, but the energy of Venus is the energy of waking up. You get this great Botticelli picture of Venus arising out of the depths in all her beauty to arouse life, to awaken life. And in a way that, you know, that's the kind of qualities that we're finding here. Spring in winter. You know, it's that. Okie dokie, that's enough. We need to have our lunch. So, well, have a nice lunch, everybody, and we'll come back together at 1:30, and pursue the old trail that is always new. Yeah. Take care.
Thank you.
Take care, guys. Good. See you later.